Well, has been announced. We're considering this question of what it means to be made in the image of God and to do the one thing that God put us here to do and to measure our success by whether we have actually done that. And we talked about how love is the great commandment and it is the foundation of all things, and everything else the Bible has to say is just unpacking for us what it means to love as God is love and as God loves us and as we should love one another. And so we talked about humility yesterday as a dimension of love. And you just think about it. Humility, by its very definition, is this manifestation of love, because the very moment you start thinking about yourself and you care about yourself more than the other, that is no longer, by definition, love. And we're going to talk about another topic today, and it is that of service. And the question I ask you is, what kind of pie is it? Well, this comes from a very interesting story from my years of preaching in Muncie, Indiana, about the only thing in Muncie is Ball State University. And about the only reason anyone's ever heard of Ball State University is David Letterman is their famous alum. And we would get from across the state of Indiana Christian students who would come to Ball State to study. And, of course, you get a wide variety, some very, very good, mature Christians, some that they just show up one time and for some reason felt compelled to get their name on the roll and never see them again. Well, we had a very fine elderly Christian lady there by the name of Lucy. In fact, one of my grandchildren are named after her because she was such a wonderful a person and an influence in our oldest daughter's life. And she just would open her home to people. She, you know, never met a stranger. She just, you know, wonderful, a picture of hospitality. And so one Sunday, she asked these two college students, would you like to come over for some pie? And they said, well, what kind of pie is it? Now, I might ask the question, what kind of pie is it, just out of curiosity. But the reason they asked the question was, well, if it's the kind of pie I want, I will come, but if it's not, forget it. And I wonder sometimes if we're asking that kind of question, you know, what's in it for me? You know, what am I going to get out of this? And the clincher to this story is, later on, these same two college kids would complain that nobody at the congregation was friendly, no one ever asked them to their home, and it's like, are you out of your mind? But that's what happens when you're so self-centered and all you hear is what you want to hear and all you see is what you want to see. So let's think about this question of what kind of pie this is, what it means to serve rather than seeking to be served. And so where I come from in Arkansas, we always pronounce the word service as serve us. You know, we're going to have a service tomorrow morning. Well, that sounds an awful lot like serve us. And so it really depends not so much perhaps on how you pronounce it, but how you spell it. And when we talk about service, there are two key questions that we need to ask. And the first of these is, who is responsible? And your answer to that question is going to determine in large part your perspective. And so if, as we have conditioned a lot of young people in this generation, the government, what's the government going to do about this? Or when even in a church setting, isn't somebody going to do something about, well, you know, we're always looking to someone else to take responsibility, and that's the problem. This victimization mentality, this institutional mentality where you look to some organization in order to do things for you, it just guts any sense of personal accountability, personal responsibility. And so who's responsible? Well, the Christian says, I'm responsible. I'm somebody. I will step up and do what needs to be done. And so who is responsible, me or someone else? And the other question we need to ask is, who is in need? And, of course, here, this is what I need. And so we go looking for a congregation. What are you going to do for me, right? We get this down in Tampa area because you have some 36 congregations of the Lord's people at least. And young people come from all over the country. They're looking for a congregation to worship with, and a lot of them will show up and say, "Here I am. What are you going to do for me? I'm church shopping. I'm looking for a group, and I'm comparing the services that this group offers and what this group offers, and I'll compare them, and I'll decide which one's going to give me the better deal." And what we need are young people who show up and say, "Here I am to serve. What can I do? Where are opportunities to serve? And to go where we can best serve." And so the concept is others are in need. Well, we understand, in fact, I am in need. I certainly have spiritual needs. But the problem that so many people fail to understand is the only way you're really going to grow spiritually is when you get unwrapped around yourself and you start serving other people. And then you find that something rather almost magical or miraculous happens, and that is you are growing spiritually. But as long as you're counting on someone else to do something to make you grow, it's not going to happen. And one of the reasons is because the very gospel of Jesus Christ, the message is love, and that means not love of self, but love of others. And humility, which is putting your needs aside in favor of the needs of others. That's the very definition of the gospel. And so any version of the gospel that comes across as, "What's in it for me? What about me? Are you going to serve me?" It is the opposite of the gospel itself. And so the solution is, you know, quit being wrapped up in yourself and start serving other people. And then you realize that's the way you best serve yourself. That's the way you're going to grow most spiritually. And there are also two key concepts to this question we can think about. And the first thing that we need to appreciate is that love itself is service. Just like we mentioned, love is demonstrated in humility. Humility is a dimension of love. Well, the same thing is true of service. If you truly love, you will truly serve. If you're not serving, then don't fool yourself into thinking that you're loving. Well, we're all familiar with the great commandment as Jesus gave the answer to that question in Matthew chapter 22. From Deuteronomy chapter 6, you will love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. And you may recognize that that phrase, "all your heart and all your soul," occurs repeatedly throughout the book of Deuteronomy. You get to chapter 30, and after the people have sinned and been carried off into captivity, as God warned them would happen, he says, "Even then, if you will turn to me with all your heart and all your soul, I will forgive you and bring you back to the land." Well, in similar way, you get to chapter 10, and notice in verse 12, "Now Israel, what does the Lord your God require from you but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." And it becomes abundantly clear that this great command of loving God with all your heart and all your soul, well, what does that look like in practical terms? Well, serve the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. And you could furthermore ask the question, what does that look like? Well, keep the commandments of God. Do the things that God has told you to do. Stay away from the things that God wants you to stay away from. And the same thing is true, of course, when we talk about love for our fellow man. This love your neighbor as yourself. That too manifests itself in service. If you notice in Galatians chapter 5, in connection with Paul's discussion about the works of the flesh and the fruit of the Spirit and so on, he says, beginning in verse 13, Galatians chapter 5 and verse 13, "For you were called to freedom, brethren. Only do not turn your freedom into an opportunity for the flesh, but through love serve one another. For the whole law is fulfilled in one word, in the statement, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself.'" Now, we didn't read this passage the other day, but we mentioned it as a second place where Paul appears to contradict Jesus when Jesus said the great commandment is love God. And here Paul says, no, every command is summed up in this one commandment, that you love your neighbor as yourself. And we noted there's no contradiction in that at all. To love God is to love those made in the image of God. To serve God is to serve those made in the image of God. And so through love, we serve one another. Love and service cannot be really separated from one another. But then you'll notice it's interesting in verse 15, Paul makes it clear that there are different ways we can serve the brethren. You notice what he says in verse 15? If you bite and devour one another, take care that you're not consumed by one another. How many times have you known brethren to serve up a brother on a platter like you serve turkey or something? And we bite and devour and consume one another. That's the wrong kind of serving the brethren. And we've had too much of that. But through love, we serve one another truly in humble, self-sacrificial serving without any regard whether they deserve it or not, because that's not the issue. We certainly didn't deserve it from Jesus. But there's a second key concept we need to understand about service, and this comes from, again, my own experience, my generation. This is just my opinion for what it's worth. I think my parents' generation, they went through the Great Depression, the war. The thing they most desperately wanted to do was to insulate and protect their children from any suffering, any deprivation. And so I think my generation grew up rather materialistic. I think of even the young people I knew at church, and we were all good kids. It wasn't like we were getting involved in all kinds of bad stuff we shouldn't be doing. But I have to admit, I don't think I was very spiritually minded. And when I look at the young people we have today, I do the Indiana camp for the college. We get young people from all across the Midwest there, and I work with these young people when they come down to the college. And again, no human being can accurately judge the hearts of other people, for from every indicator of how much more often these young people talk to their friends about Jesus and the number of devotions that they have and the interest that they have in Bible study and so on, I'm ashamed of myself. I mean, my children have put me to shame numerous times when I think about what I was at their age, right? And so we're very materialistic, right? And so I think when we became parents, we thought, well, we don't want to make that same mistake. And so I think my generation as parents, we have done a pretty good job of teaching our children to be more spiritually minded and to be more service-minded toward others. But here's where I think we've made the mistake. We've made the mistake by convincing our children that service is a very important part of the Christian life. And I'm here to tell you it is not. In fact, service is the totality of the Christian life. Service is all there is. And by service, we're talking about serving other people. Because that's what love looks like. That's what love is. I mean, you might as well say that love is an important part of the Christian life. No, love is the totality of the Christian life. Or a Christian living is 80% humility. No, it's 100% humility. And it's 100% serving. Everything we do is in the service of God and His purpose, His glory. And as part of that, we are serving our fellow man as we have opportunity to do that. And so we need to teach our young people. We need to teach ourselves. We need to remind ourselves that service is all there is. And we're constantly being called to serve. Not just serve sometimes, not just to serve in times of great need, but we're constantly serving. You know, that's our mentality. And that is, in fact, what the Hebrew writer says in Hebrews chapter 10. You know, verse 25 gets all this attention. You know, you got to go to church. Church attendance is mandatory. Well, that's not what verse 25 says. I like to tell my students, verse 25 doesn't say anything. And they go, what? You have to have a complete sentence to say something. Now, some sentences are very short. Run! That's a complete sentence. But verse 25 is not a complete sentence. I don't know who decided to put the verse divisions where they do, but verse 25 doesn't say anything. You've got to have the whole sentence, and the whole sentence is, beginning of verse 24, let us consider one another to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as the habit of some, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day drawing near. And it becomes pretty obvious the command there is consider your brother. You're always thinking of your brother. That's humility. That's love. And it's service. Because he doesn't say, think about him, and then sit there and say, okay, I've done that. Let's go. But you think about how you can motivate him to love and good deeds. Not only you are serving him, but you're trying to stimulate him to serve as he needs to be serving, right? And it's very interesting because this word to provoke, We've had too much of the wrong kind of provoking, brethren, to provoke or to stimulate, whatever your version might say. It comes from the word for vinegar. And I like to think of this visual image. If you were to take a swig of straight vinegar, whoo! You know, that's a jolt. That's the way our assemblies ought to be, as we're assembling together and encouraging one another. We're jolted. You know, we're encouraged to go out and serve and to love more deeply and more effectively. And that's what we're here for. And so that's what's bound up in this idea of service that we're talking about. And so, again, service is what it's all about. Notice a key passage. I've kind of been alluding to this as we've gone along. But Mark chapter 10, and there's a parallel account to this in Matthew chapter 20. But I like Mark's account. For one thing, I'm teaching the Gospel of Mark this semester down at the college. And it's striking that when you get to chapter 8, of course, you have this highlight right in the middle of the book. Jesus says, "Who do people say that I am?" And they say, "Oh, well, John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the other old prophets." And then Jesus says, "Well, who do you say that I am?" And then Peter, probably speaking on behalf of the other disciples as well, says, "Well, you're the Christ. You're the Messiah." Now, it becomes abundantly clear in the very next story that Peter has no clue what that really means. He probably is still thinking of a Messiah like most Jews were expecting. He's going to get an army together, go fight the Romans. That's our problem. And Jesus is going to have to educate them and say, "No, your problem is sin. And that's what I've come to defeat." And so it is only when the disciples say, "You are the Christ," that only then does Jesus explicitly begin predicting his death. And so once Peter says, "You're the Christ," he says, "Okay, now let me tell you, I've got to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things at the hands of the chief priest and the scribes, and to be put to death and rise again 3 days later." I mean, that's pretty blunt. That's pretty straightforward. And what does Peter do? "Oh, no, Jesus, don't talk that way." Now, we're not, the words of Peter are not recorded for us. I don't know exactly what he said, but I can easily picture Peter saying something, "Oh, you're a glasses half empty kind of guy, Jesus. You're being pessimistic. You know, if God's on our side, we outnumber anybody. Think about old Gideon back in the Old Testament." I don't know what he said, but it boiled down to this: "Jesus, you don't know what you're talking about. Shut up." And that's why then Transfiguration takes place, and the Lord makes the point, the voice, God speaking out of the cloud, saying, "This is my beloved Son. Listen to him. If he tells you he's got to go to Jerusalem and die, that's what's got to happen." So that's what happens the first time Jesus predicts his death. What happens the second time he predicts his death in chapter 9? Well, again, the disciples do something foolish. They start arguing about who's greatest in the kingdom. The third time Jesus predicts his death, chapter 10, now James and John, they want positions of preeminence in the kingdom. They even put their mother up to asking Jesus on their behalf. And the other disciples, they get upset. Of course, they're not upset because, "Oh, James, John, you don't understand what the kingdom is about. You don't understand Jesus is not that kind of king." No, they're mad because they didn't think of it first. Why didn't we get mom to do this for us? And what does Jesus do? Well, we read of the response here of Jesus in Mark chapter 10. And so here's the pattern of the disciples. Each time Jesus tells them, this is what the kingdom is about. It is a kingdom of suffering. It is a kingdom of sacrifice. Is it a kingdom of self-denial? It is a kingdom of fully surrendering yourself in death to serve other people who don't deserve it. That's what the kingdom is about. Well, can I be great? Can it be all about me? And you're just like, are you deaf? You know, how thick-skulled are you people? I just can't imagine how frustrating this would be for Jesus. But what does Jesus do? Well, notice Mark chapter 10, verse 42. Calling them to himself, Jesus said to them, "You know that those who are recognized as rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their great men exercise authority over them." And it's not difficult for us to understand what verse 42 is talking about. Jesus is basically saying, you know how things work in the world. The world's concept of authority. But it's not to be that way among you. So verse 43, it is not this way among you. But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant. Whoever wishes to be first among you shall be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. And so when we go looking for that congregation, are we looking for an opportunity to serve, or are we looking for somebody that's going to serve us? And there's all the difference in the world in that attitude. Do we want to be served, or do we want to serve? Well, what is Jesus like? And as just as we mentioned the other day, the moment you figure out who Jesus is and what he's like, then you know that's the way you're supposed to be. And so this is Jesus. I've come to serve, not to be served. And that must be our attitude as well. So that leads me to ask this question: how well are you serving? And I'm going to send you off on a guilt trip here. I'm going to let you know you're not doing nearly enough for Jesus. Now, how do I know that? Well, I got another kind of pie for you. This is a pie chart, right? So this is the typical Christian life. You take your 168 hours of the week, and you roughly sleep 8 hours a day, you know, more or less, we know, but that's a third of your time right there sleeping on the job. And maybe 30% of your time you're involved in some kind of secular employment, hooking up somebody's plumbing, teaching somebody's kids in a classroom, putting roofing on a house, whatever it is. And then we got some household chores we got to take care of, like mowing the yard and painting, and maybe some time for recreation. We got to eat, you know, and maybe just take some personal time. But, you know, you take a typical congregation that meets for Sunday morning Bible class and Sunday morning worship and Sunday evening worship and Wednesday night Bible study. If you take that 4 hours out of a 168-hour week, that's 2%. Well, that's a very small piece of the pie that you're giving to God. And that's just terrible. And when you look at a pie chart like that, you think, well, man, I'm doing terrible. Maybe I can cut back on my sleep. If I take 2 hours each day and sleep 2 hours less, and I'll take that and go knock on doors and tell people about Jesus, but that's still an awful small piece of pie. And so a lot of Christians, they look at this pie chart and they feel very guilty. But my point is, we shouldn't feel guilty. What we need to understand is, this whole pie is given to God. The mistake we make is when we equate what we do as a congregation with what we're giving to God. It's important what we do together as a congregation. It is a support group. But the fact of the matter is, I am a follower of Jesus Christ, not the follower of any church. I am a Christian, not a churchian. And I don't want to minimize the importance of, you know, God's wisdom and calling us together to have this support group to help one another. But the fact of the matter is, your service to God is your service to God. Let me tell you a story about a fella who felt very guilty because he looked at his life as a pie and he wasn't doing very much to tell his neighbors about Jesus. And he just felt so bad, and he comes dragging and says, I just don't think we're doing enough. And you ask him, well, should we have more worship services throughout the week? Oh, no, that's not what he's talking about. And this congregation spending 99% of the money it takes in on evangelism and other, you know, efforts to spread the gospel, do we need to spend more money on evangelism? No, that's not what he meant. What he was looking for was if the congregation would have some kind of outreach program, some kind of organized effort to get people involved in talking to their neighbors. And so the congregation said, okay, we'll do that. You know, we can help equip one another and encourage one another to do that work. And so they start some kind of outreach program. And now this fella, he slept well at night. He felt so good about himself. But he wasn't participating in the program. He wasn't doing one thing more now than he was doing before. But why did he feel so better? Because he had this institutional conception of the church that by virtue of having his name in the directory, that whatever activity the group was doing, he could somehow take credit for that. And what does that do, as we've already mentioned? It guts individual, personal, spiritual accountability and responsibility. And that's the real pernicious thing about an institutional conception of the church. And it manifests itself in things like this. This is what I'm doing for God. What I do for the church is equal to what I do for God. Nonsense. When I spend time with my children trying to teach and instruct them, I am glorifying God and I am fulfilling the holy commandments God has given me to do. When I'm playing ball with my son in the backyard, I am doing a holy work. When I am taking care of my aged parents and feeding them so they don't have to eat out of a trash can, I am fulfilling the command to honor my mother and my father. You remember that story in Mark chapter 7 about Corban? And that was the very concept. Oh, Mom, don't you think the temple's more holy than you? What aged mother isn't going to say, well, no, I'm more important than God. Give me the money. She's going to say, oh, yes, I can eat cat food. That's fine, you know. And that's commendable to her. But it's an abomination that any child would treat their parent that way. You know, we got to get away from this notion that the only holy activities are those that are overtly religious. I'm only being holy when I'm knocking on someone's door trying to tell them about Jesus or when I'm sitting in a church building. The fact of the matter is, if the entirety of your life is not given to God, if the whole pie doesn't belong to God, you don't understand what it means to serve God. You don't understand that God has made a total and complete claim on your entire life. Everything is for God. And that's true of our money as well. We often make the mistake of thinking, well, you know, the money I contribute on the Lord's Day into the local treasury of a local church, that's the money I'm given to God. Well, that's true. But doesn't all your money already belong to God? Every last penny of it? When you pay your mortgage? When you feed your children? Is that not God's money? Well, of course it is. Every penny of it already belongs to Him. And how you allocate your resources is a decision you have to make, and one that only you can make for yourself, no one else can, and a decision for which you will give an account on the day of judgment about how you've spent your money. But all of that is allocating your resources to serve God. And if I need to allocate some of my resources to take care of my aged parents, to honor them, that's money I'm using as God commands me to use it. And that's in service to Him. That's money given to God. When I'm feeding my children like I'm supposed to, that's money given to God. And so I don't quibble about people who say we're returning this to the Lord. That's true. But when we leave the impression that's the only money we're giving God, I think that's where we make the mistake. And again, it's because what we're doing for the church is what we're doing for God. No, it's all for God. And that also helps us with certain things, you know. Occasionally a congregation will have some special need and they'll make some special plea for contributing more money to take care of this need. And somebody will always say, well, they're supposed to be given every last penny they could to begin with. And if the contribution goes up, that's just proof people have been holding out. No, it's proof that people have been allocating their resources in a different way. And once you alert them to the fact there's a special need, they say, can we readjust some things? I mean, I've done that. I had a brother who was in Romania for 12 years, and occasionally I would send him some financial assistance. Well, if I found out there was some greater need locally, I could easily say, well, do you mind if I, you know, take this money I've been sending you and send it over here? No, that's fine. That's a special need. And so we have that kind of flexibility, but the question is always, how can we best serve the Lord? And that's a decision we make, not just of our money, but of our time, the energy that we have, whatever blessings God has given to us, how do we allocate them to serve God? And we need to see how serving one another, taking care of our families, these other things are part of our serving the Lord. And so the whole pie belongs to God. Now, how do I know that? Well, turn over to Colossians chapter 3, and we'll notice this is exactly what Paul says. So Colossians chapter 3, I think verse 17 is a passage we've heard quoted many times. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus. That is all under His authority and His ownership, that His name is stamped on everything because it belongs to Him, giving thanks through Him to God the Father. Now, my question is, does Paul really mean this? Is everything really for God? Well, that's what he said. I take Paul at his word. But as you go back and look at that pie chart, the way a lot of us have been conditioned in our service to God, in our concept of religion, sleeping? Is sleeping for God? Because, you know, when you're looking at a pagan sleeping and a Christian sleeping, there's not a whole lot of difference between the two. You can't look at a person sleeping and say, oh, I can tell he's sleeping for his pagan deity. Or this atheist over here, they're just sleeping for themselves. But the fact of the matter is, we sleep for an entirely different reason than most people sleep. We sleep because it's a necessary part of life. And whose idea was it to make us need to sleep? Well, that was God's. And do we not honor God, our Creator, when we do what He created us to do? Why do we have to waste so much time eating? Well, it's a pleasurable thing, for one. And a lot of people do it in a very self-centered kind of way. But the Christian is constantly being reminded, look how God cares for me. Look how God has provided for me. Every time we eat, why three times a day? Why not just once a day? Why not be like some snakes? We only need to eat, what, once every 2 years? Because each one is an opportunity to be reminded that God has blessed us. This is the source of life. It comes from God. And so when we're constantly being reminded of that, we receive the food, the blessing from God with thanksgiving, with prayer, as Paul says, then it is a blessing to God, and it's a reminder to us. And so we're honoring God, certainly, but we're also, it is a spiritual exercise as well, or can be, if we will have the right attitude toward it. But notice a passage in the Old Testament, Zechariah chapter 7. This is one of my favorite passages from the Old Testament because it's just one of those that never gets studied because it's in the Minor Prophets. And it says something that rather flies in the face of very common perception about God and what it means to serve God. So Zechariah chapter 7, it's kind of toward the end of the Old Testament. Fortunately, it's the longest of the minor prophets, so it's easier to find than some of those short ones. But Zechariah chapter 7, now the setting of this is, Zechariah, of course, is one of the restoration prophets. People have been carried off into captivity. They've been there for 70 years. And they're on the cusp of coming back to the promised land, where many of them have already come back. And, of course, the temple needs to be rebuilt, and Zechariah and Haggai are instrumental in getting that project back off the ground. And so the question that is being asked is, look, you know, for 70 years, we have special days of fasting that we've started. We have a fast to commemorate the day the walls of Jerusalem were breached. And we have a day to commemorate the day the temple was burned to the ground. And we have a day to commemorate when Gedaliah the governor was murdered. But now that we get to come back and we're rebuilding the temple and reoccupying the land, and all of that now is being reversed, you know, that's like a chapter of our history that's now closed. Should we now move on and quit fasting? Do we need to keep fasting? That's the question that they come to Zechariah with. So let's pick up the story then in Zechariah chapter 7 and verse 5. Say to all the people of the land and to the priests, when you fasted and mourned in the fifth and the seventh months, these 70 years, was it really for me that you fasted? When you eat and drink, do you not eat for yourselves? Do you not drink for yourselves? Well, how did the Lord know they were eating and drinking for themselves? Well, of course, the Lord can judge the hearts of people. He can see directly. But I suspect there's a extent to which even we can judge, certainly for ourselves, whether we're eating and drinking for God. Now, you'll realize this is an illustration of this very point when we make the argument that everything is to be given to God. Your whole pie belongs to God. That slice that is devoted to eating and drinking, does it belong to God? Zechariah says it does. You should eat and drink for God. But how does that look any different than some pagan, some non-Christian eating and drinking for God? You know, you come peek in my neighbor's window, him sitting in his dining room and eating, I doubt it's going to look that different when you peek in my dining room window and watch me eating. It's not like Christians hold their finger out, you know, their pinkies in some special Christian pinky posture. You know, but it is an attitude of heart. My next door neighbor may be eating simply because he's hungry. I eat because that's part of staying alive, and staying alive to serve God and serve my fellow man, and to remember he's the one that has blessed me to enjoy these things and to return them to him in service and to his glory. And so, if you're to kind of update the point in Zechariah, the point that Zechariah is making, look, you think because a couple days out of the year, you're going to come and do some special thing for God. Well, let's fast for God. But on your daily life, you're just doing things for yourself. Don't fool yourself into thinking these special days are really for God. That's just to salve your conscience. You're just trying to make yourself feel better. And the modern application of that would be, don't go out and live your life Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday and Saturday just doing whatever you want, and then think you're going to come here on Sunday, and, oh, I'm doing this for God. I'm serving the Lord. I'm putting a check in the collection plate. I'm taking the Lord's Supper. Look how holy I am. And God will say, you're not here for me. You're just here for yourself. And how do I know that? Well, I'm looking at how you're living on Monday. You're doing that for yourself. I look at how you're living on Tuesday. You're just doing that for yourself. So I'm not fooled. And so don't fool yourself. That's what God would say to us. And so do we really eat and drink for God? Well, yes. And we could add to that all the other wholesome and godly things that God requires of us. I would even point out that we are to serve God totally and completely, even in our limited circumstances. If we go back to Colossians chapter 3, you remember verse 17, whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus. Well, that phrase occurs again a little bit later in this chapter. Verse 22, slaves, in all things, obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord. Whatever you do, again, just like in verse 17, whatever you do, do your work heartily as for the Lord rather than for men, knowing that from the Lord you will receive the reward of the inheritance. Here we are talking about people that are slaves, whose life is not their own, their time is not their own, but they're Christians. Now, slaves in the first century had some degree of freedom. They weren't just chained to one place and couldn't go anywhere. But they were subject to the instructions of their master. You know, I've heard Christians sometimes say, oh, I can't wait to retire and then I can serve the Lord. Well, I don't mean to quibble. I think I understand what they mean by that. They'll have more time to fully devote to things. And the Bible even uses that language. You know, Acts chapter 18, when Timothy shows up, presumably with some money from the Macedonian Christians, it says that Paul then devoted himself to the Word. Well, was Paul being half devoted to the Word of God before? Well, no. It means he was devoting more time overtly to the preaching of the gospel. And so we can use that terminology, but if in fact we believe that we are limited in how we can serve the Lord now, no. You know, most of us do work at secular employment, and that's a necessary thing. It is a desirable thing. God wants us to be productive. And we may not overtly see the holy activity that comes from our effort, but it is there. You know, think of the computer programmers who have devoted their talents to giving us the internet. Now, I know there's a lot of trash on the internet, but there's a lot of good that has been used. The internet's used to propagate the gospel to people, and that's in service of the Lord. And that would not be possible if it wasn't for people who use their talents in that way. Or what about sanitation and plumbing? Can you imagine what our culture would be like if we didn't have sanitation and plumbing? We'd have a lot more disease and sickness. We have a lot more immediate urgent problems. We'd be distracted by the fact that we have the luxury of these things. And so some Christian plumber who is doing his part, it's all the great tapestry of God, and each thread is woven together by God to make the picture of what God wants it to look like. And so when we're being a good roofer or a plumber or a factory worker, whatever it is, we're doing that for the Lord. And the monies that we're earning, we're devoting to the Lord because they belong to him as well. And so if a slave in the first century can serve the Lord, then so can we. And it's obvious that Paul's not talking about pretend you're serving the Lord. He says at the end of verse 24, it is the Lord Christ whom you serve. Even as a slave, as you go about doing your slave work, you're serving the Lord. And we are too in the various wholesome activities and responsibilities that we have. And one final passage we'll look at in the remaining time we have. Matthew chapter 25, we referred to this passage a little bit in passing the other day. Matthew chapter 25, it's a very familiar story, verse 31 through the end of the chapter, verse 46, of a judgment picture of the righteous and the wicked that are gathered, and the sheep and the goats are separated right and left. And I don't think it is a picture of the judgment of all people here, because if you read the story carefully, it appears as if all of these people that come before God for judgment know Jesus, and they see themselves as being religious and having served the Lord. And so when the wicked are dismissed, and Jesus says, you didn't serve me, you know, you didn't clothe me when I was naked, you didn't feed me when I was hungry, they're like, well, what are you talking about? They didn't say, who are you? You know, no, they know who Jesus is, but their problem is, oh, we were beat tickled pink to have served you, but we never saw that you were in need. And of course, the answer Jesus gives, well, to the extent you did not do these things to the least of these, your brethren, you did not do it to me. And so it's an illustration of what we said the other day. Love for God and love for our fellow man are one and the same. No one can say that he loves God and hates his brother. And it's perfectly illustrated here in this story. And I always loved this story ever since I was a little kid because I always liked, you know, the twist of the story. You know, like in Cinderella and the Wicked Stepsisters, you know, and they get it in the end, you know. Not like the Disney version, you know. I mean, you know, make them pay, you know. And so here they're strutting around thinking they're somebody, and you know, wham, you see that you're nobody. And so here are these wicked people who think, oh, we're such good Christians. And Jesus said, you've not served me because you weren't serving your fellow man. And so they're shocked. And I always liked a good mystery story, a good shock, you know, there at the end. But here's the interesting thing about this story. Have you ever thought about this? Why are the righteous shocked? You know, he says to the righteous, oh, come on in. You've been serving me. What are you talking about? Well, to the extent you did these things to the least of these, your brethren, you were doing it to me. So why are the righteous shocked on the day of judgment? Didn't they know they were serving their fellow man? Of course they did. I mean, I'm pretty certain you know of certain things you've done for other people. Someone has a death in the family. You bake a bowl of spaghetti. You take it over to them. Is that a holy activity? Is that a service to God? It is. I think the shock here is when we take a bowl of spaghetti to somebody as a righteous person, we just do it because it's the right thing to do. We don't really give that much thought to it. As a matter of fact, years later, people may say, you remember that bowl of spaghetti you brought me when my mama died? He'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about. I take it they remember it happened, but I have no memory of that. But you know, you got somebody's got a little book, and they're keeping track. Oh, well, I'm glad Sister So-and-so died. I'm going to make some spaghetti, and we're going to take it over there, and I bet you that's going to be worth 5 points. You know, on the day of judgment, God's going to open the book, and it's going to say, bowl of spaghetti, 5 points. Whoo! Now we're cooking, right? And with that attitude, it's like, this is how I'm going to manipulate God. This is how I'm going to get some brownie points, you know. Well, no. The attitude of the righteous is, this is just the right thing to do, and you do it almost without thinking. And then to find out that the Lord values it that much, that's the shock on the day of judgment. Now, here's the interesting thing. We read Matthew chapter 25, and it's like, well, now I'm not going to be shocked. Because when I go stand before Jesus, I know he's going to say, Tom, come on in, because you were serving your fellow man. I'm not going to be shocked at all, because I've been warned ahead of time. It's kind of like throwing a surprise birthday party. And then someone says, they're going to throw a surprise birthday party for you. Well, I'm not going to be shocked now, because you told me. Cat's out of the bag. But even then, could you still surprise somebody? Of course. You show up, and, wow, the President of the United States is there. Or something extraordinary. And I think even though we know we're going to be shocked, I think we're going to be shocked just how much we're going to be shocked. Because it's just like throwing a rock in a pond and those ripples that just keep going and going and going. We're going to find out on the day of judgment that some little simple act of kindness had consequences and ramifications far beyond anything we could have begun to imagine. And sin works the same way too. That little sin, that little lie we told, it's harmless. And we're going to find out it did enormous damage. Now, on the other hand, it may be that on the day of judgment, I find out my bowl of spaghetti was just a bowl of spaghetti, and that's as far as it went. I do it because it's the right thing to do. God takes it and uses it for whatever His purpose is, according to His wisdom and His power. And He is certainly capable of taking that bowl of spaghetti and doing great things with it. That it can have an impact in somebody's life that makes the entire difference in how they live the rest of their life and the influences they have on other people. And if on the day of judgment you found out because you took a stupid bowl of spaghetti to somebody that entire nations rose and fell, wouldn't you be shocked? If the Lord said to you, 10,000 people became Christians because of this bowl of spaghetti, wouldn't you be shocked? And you'd know, it's not the spaghetti. I'm not that great a cook. It wasn't that great a spaghetti. But it's because the power of God to use the simple acts of kindness that we do to return great things. And that's what's going to happen on the day of judgment. We're going to realize that, you know, we're going to be thinking, all the days on Sunday and things we did for the Lord and how many days did I miss because I was sick or was I really that sick? Maybe I should have forced myself to go. And I don't think the Lord's going to be looking on all those Sundays as much as He is those Mondays and those Tuesdays, those daily ways of living. And we're going to be shocked just how high a value God places on those things, being a good plumber, being a good roofer, being a good mother, and how little emphasis He's going to place on these big, special things like how much did we fast or some other thing that we think is going to make up and compensate for life that is not truly devoted to God.